The West may be a great place to live, but most of it is not a wet place to live. The drippy Pacific Northwest is the exception. Consider elsewhere in this part of the country. Los Angeles, 15 inches of rain a year. Reno, 7.5. We can go lower. There are lots of examples. The late Mark Reisner captured the story of the West and the reshaping of it with water policy and projects in the classic book from 1986, Cadillac Desert, The American West and Its Disappearing Water. There is another edition of the book on sale now with a postscript from last year by Lori Mott, who was married to Mark Reisner. Mark Reisner worked for many years at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Dorothy Lawrence Mott, who goes by Lori Mott, was an environmental health specialist or scientist with the NRDC and has authored many reports on people and pesticides and a book called Pesticide Alert. Lori Mott, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Happy to be with you.
Can we assume you were with Mark as he worked on what became Cadillac Desert?
Indeed, I was. In fact, I remember driving around many of the places that you listed in your weather report with Marcus, who rafted on the Klamath or camped on the northern coast of California or visited his relatives in Oregon. So I have spent a lot of time in your area when Mark was working on the book.
And so just in terms of the information you were finding, was this sort of like a thread you pulled that just kept leading to more and bigger threads?
Well, are you talking about the postscript that I wrote or what Mark was doing?
Mark's work, yeah.
Mark's work. He dove into, he started unraveling threads, and he dove into research in a way that I think most of your listeners would not even be aware of nowadays. He had to look at documents on microfiche readers. He went into archives at universities and looked at hardcover documents that, for example, Commissioner Floyd Donnelly had donated or some of the other people at the Bureau of Reclamation. So it was really a much more of a physical task of going places, libraries in Wyoming, traveling across the country and looking at primary sources in written documents. There was no internet when Martin wrote the book. So that's why it took him 10 years. And that's why, you know, particularly when I was doing the update, it was remarkable to think about how he pulled all this information together in the era before the internet.
Yeah, I'm amazed myself sometimes at the amount of research that people were able to do before the internet, because it is that much faster now anyway. The title of the book, Lori, Cadillac Desert, is and always has been resonant. Where did that come from?
Mark saw the image.
Okay, we got some serious cell phone fade here, and I think we might have lost you completely. Oh, here you come back.
Are you having reception trouble?
Yes, yeah, we have you back now.
Okay.
All right, so you were telling us the story of the title of Cadillac Desert?
So he was very much like the image, that photographic image of, you know, buried front end first and a slant in the desert. And just thought it was a striking image of sort of the absurdity of taking a hugely expensive machine and burying it in the sand. That sort of struck him as a metaphor for what he was finding with the way water projects were developed in the 20th century.
And now we have an overlay because, I mean, when the book was first published in 1986, how big a factor or a concern was climate change?
Well, beginning to be a factor. I think it was 1986 when first testified before the U.S. Congressional subcommittee about global warming, as it was then called. And Mark has some mentions of it in the book, but if I was asked what was the biggest thing that changed since when Mark wrote the book and even when he did an update in 1992, climate change is front and center. It's just completely heightened the spotlight about how precarious and precious our water supplies are.
Well, all right, so even without climate change, how precarious is that lifeline of water to major Western cities?
I would say, ironically, in some cases, Western cities are pretty well taken care of, because what urban areas can do and have done is urban users can conserve their water use. They can dramatically shorten their showers. There are a number of water-saving devices that can be put in place. Many cities, for example, Los Angeles, in the lead, have tracked water so that if they do not want to rely on imports from far away, ways. They can do things like reclaim wastewater and fish, or they actually revisit for potable use. So they have an opportunity to reclaim wastewater. They have an opportunity to store water and reuse that. So I would pretty optimistic about if cities are forward-thinking and make the investment in wastewater recycling and stormwater capture and water conservation, they'll be okay.
Your postscript starts with the Colorado River. Is it the poster child of overpromised water?
The Colorado River, and then the south of the border of Mexico, and it's amazing that is so, certainly. It Delta has made prices no longer any water. Well, it's falling to its Delta.
Okay, Lori, we're getting about like every fifth word at this point. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to have Patrick hang up on you, and then we'll call you back and see if we can get a better cell and get better reception when we call you back. No problem.
Okay.
So we're going to a break anyway. So we're talking to Lori Mott about her postscript to Mark Reisner's book, Cadillac Desert, The American West and Its Disappearing Water. So we'll come back and talk more with her on a different phone line, we hope. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Lori Mott and your phone calls and emails in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We have a chance to talk about Cadillac Desert, the classic book about the American West and water, written by Mark Reisner in 1986 and updated a few years later. It came out again last year with a new postscript from Lori Mott, who was married to Mark Reisner and herself an environmental health scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council for many years, has herself authored many reports on people and pesticides in a book called Pesticide Alert. So we're focusing on primarily the addition to the book, this postscript that Lori Mott wrote. You can join the conversation on the Exchange about water in the West, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's come back to the Colorado River, because it does seem like this is a place that has many more promises than it has the capacity to deliver.
Indeed it does. And one of the big issues right now is that the parties, all the states along the Colorado River and the country of Mexico, are trying to come to what's called a drought contingency agreement. There are old requirements in place that once the levels at Lake Mead drop below a certain height, that water restrictions go into effect for Arizona and Nevada and California, with Arizona and basically suffering the largest cutbacks. And that would just be a political, you can imagine the political outrage if Arizona did not get much of its water and California still continued to get most of its water. So the parties are all trying to come to an agreement about how to share the pain during a time of shortage. And this is a really remarkable effort. It still hasn't succeeded, but the fact that the parties are trying to share the pain and come up with some mutually acceptable agreements, as opposed to going back to the courts or going back to the Congress and fighting the way they have in the past, is a sign of hope. But the fact that it has dragged on as long as it has is also worrisome.
Lori, how different is Lake Mead's level versus what it was historically?
Well, it is about, if you fly over it in a plane or you stand beside it, as I have done, there is a huge white bathtub ring between the Blue Lake and the red-brown rocks in the area that marks the stripe of how far the water has dropped. And it's about the height of about 150 feet, which is about the height of the Statue of Liberty. And that is, it's really at its lowest level ever. And it is really close. It's within a foot or two of going into that shortage declaration, which would trigger the cutbacks to largely to Arizona.
So I guess I didn't realize how much Las Vegas, for example, which is right near Lake Mead and gets water from it, how much it had grown. It tripled in population in the 20 years after 1990. And it's interesting because you look at the amount of water used in places like the Fountain of the Bellagio, which you couldn't avoid mentioning, I'm sure. But Las Vegas actually has some stuff going on with conservation, doesn't it?
Las Vegas recycles every single drop of the water it uses except for that which goes to landscape. Everything that goes down the drain, down the toilet, those fountains, everything goes to a plant. It's recycled, cleaned, and pumped back into Lake Mead. They do this because they have a very small allocation, because when the allocations of the Colorado River were first made in 1922, Las Vegas was not even a dream in the eye of the, founders of Nevada, the state of Nevada. And they have done an incredible job. They recycle all of their water. And that's why I'm hopeful that, cities, if they would get with the program, could really make some, improvements here on water use. The only areas I mentioned for Las Vegas that water doesn't get recycled is that which goes to water our outdoor irrigation. And the Water Agency in Las Vegas made a very serious effort to encourage people to get rid of their lawns, giving them rebates. And now if you walk around the neighborhoods in Las Vegas on the outskirts of the city, you'll see mostly cactus, rock gardens, maybe a little plastic sod, but largely, the traditional kind of landscape there, not the, verdant East Coast lawn image.
I still remain shocked at the fact that for all that water use, Las Vegas's annual rainfall is a little more than 4 inches.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, particularly when you go there and you look at how, it is a desert. It is a white rock desert, and it is stunning that people decided to build this, jostling casino megalopolis there with the electronic billboards and that are in so stark contrast to what is just outside of the city limits.
So what we're talking about here, though, so far is urban use of water. And as we come back to the Colorado River itself, I mean, how much of the water from the river is devoted to cities versus agriculture?
It's sort of the same percentage for the Colorado as it is for California. 30% of the Colorado goes for urban use. 70% goes for agriculture. And where I think we really need progress if we're going to continue to survive, particularly with climate emergency, as I call it, continuing and worsening, is that agriculture has to seriously rethink its use of water far more than it already has.
Well, and then some of the examples you give here in just the amount of work and energy it takes to get water onto crops, like the physics of the Central Arizona project. Can you tell us about the energy use and the physics of that?
The Central Arizona project requires pumping water 2,000 feet uphill, many, many, many miles. The energy to do that is produced by a huge coal-burning power plant called the Navajo Generating Power Station. And 90% of the water, of the electricity that single largest user in Arizona uses is for that Central Arizona project. And it's kind of insane. I mean, nowadays, one would never build a project that required pumping water uphill that far. It's too energy intensive. But it's a challenge. It's also going to be a further challenge because the owners and operators of the coal-burning power plant have decided to cease the operation of the power plant in the end of 2019. So that source of energy for the Central Arizona project to pump its water uphill to its farms and to Phoenix as well is possibly going to be offline.
Lori Mott is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of a postscript to her late husband Mark Reisner's book, Cadillac Desert, the American West and its Disappearing Water. There are other agreements that you point out about the use of Colorado River water. And so what is up with trying to save and or clean up the Salton Sea in Southern California?
Oh, boy, that's a complex problem. I don't think many people realize that. At first, I'm not sure many people in Southern California realize how much they are dependent on Colorado River water. That's in Los Angeles and even as far away as San Diego. The Salton Sea was created by an accident in the early turn of the 20th century when some irrigation canals that took water from the Colorado River to farms in the Imperial Valley, which is the driest southeastern portion of California. The irrigation canals breached and they flooded what was then the Salton Sink, an area below sea level, creating the Salton Sea, which is actually almost twice the size of Lake Tahoe. Most people, I suspect, don't even know that it exists, nor do they know the peril it is in. And, you know, at one point it was a resort destination for Los Angelinos. Since then, as water flows to the Salton Sea have dwindled and become more concentrated with both pesticides and fertilizers and salts, the water has become toxic to birds and fish, and it has been a critical stopover on the Pacific Flyway, the North American Pacific Flyway. And there have been a whole series of agreements attempting to work on protecting it. We've made some progress recently. There's some money in Governor Jerry Brown's budget for it. The state has adopted a three-year plan with some benchmarks, so we may be inching forward finally, and I'm hoping that it will, you know, there'll be enough political force with whoever the next governor is in California to continue the progress.
Now, further downstream, I was really kind of shocked, and not for the first time, evidently, about where the Colorado River usually ends.
Yes, normally there was a delta that went, the river flowed all the way to the Sea of Cortez or the top of the Gulf of Baja. And in fact, it no longer flows past the last dam on the Colorado, which is the Morales Dam, which is at the border of Arizona and California and Mexico. And it just stops there. Below it, it is literally a river of sand choked with trees, weeds, shrubs. But a very important agreement between Mexico, the U.S. states, and some nonprofits in both Mexico and in the U.S. led to a one-time effort to, if you will, to restore the delta, or at least not restore the entire delta, restore sampling of all the different types of habitat down the river to the delta. They called it an emerald necklace of biodiversity. And they had a one-time pulse flow. The gates of the dam opened. Water went down. It actually, this is in 2014, it actually reached all the way to the delta for the first time since 1998. A little trickle reached there. And that started the restoration project with water not continuing to flow down the river stretch itself, but instead to buy water from farmers in Mexico and direct that water to specific restoration projects. Great news, much excitement. People, for example, came out in San Luis de Colorado, a town that had a bridge over the river where it used to go, and suddenly there was a river there, and people were, you know, playing in the water. Children had never seen it before. Adults thought it would never return. This is a place where steamers used to come up from the Sea of Cortez. They'd come up the Colorado River to this town. So it was a pretty remarkable change. That's the good news. The bad news now is that, unfortunately, that agreement has expired, and they are attempting to renegotiate a continued agreement, but things between Mexico and the U.S. are a little more complicated now, shall we say.
Yes, that is a fair statement. We are talking about water in the West, as portrayed in Mark Reisner's book, Cadillac Desert, The American West and Its Disappearing Water. The book first came out in 1986, was updated in the early 90s. Lori Mott was married to Mark Reisner, who died in 2000, and she has written a new postscript to the book as of last year and is talking to us about the process of figuring out the West's water all over again. You can join the conversation on the exchange and talk about your concerns about water usage in the West and things we might do to conserve. What have you been doing to conserve? Join the conversation. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Lori, you mentioned in your postscript that there's always interest in new water storage. It seems like somebody says every week, you know, we should have a dam here to hold this water back, that water back, that kind of thing. But you mentioned that the federal and state government are really out of supporting dams?
Yes, entirely. Primarily just because of the financial realities. Most of the dams that Mark wrote about in the book that were built in the 20th century, the big ones in the early parts of the 20th century, Lake Mead, Powell, Lake Powell, you know, those dams, they were built largely by the Bureau and the Army Corps of Engineers. Then the next wave of dams were largely supported, much smaller, albeit large, by state projects, largely in California, some in Oregon and Washington, and throughout the rest of the West. But nowadays, because of tightening budgets, nobody, in fact, will... You can't, you know, the feds nor the state don't have the money to pay billions of dollars for new water storage projects. In fact, there are a number proposed in California right now. There are two big dams proposed, Sites and Temperance Flat. They cost between $3 and $5 billion, and they have to be supported largely through fees of the people who benefit from the water that is provided by those dams. There's a little bit of state money that they can get. I think through a recent process, one of the dams got about 7%, and the other one got maybe 15%. But that's a pittance compared to billions of dollars that water users, and these are largely farmers, are going to have to pay for this water. So I would hazard that those dams won't make it through the financial review, because even if the farmers do borrow the money to pay for those dams, they're going to borrow it from Wall Street, who's going to be a lot tougher on the repayment than the feds were on repayments.
So in addition to the more or less a proscription on new dams, or at least getting support from the feds and the state, there's also the issue of all the existing dams. And I think we got a bit of a lesson with Oroville Dam a couple of winters ago.
Absolutely. Let's see, in 2025, 75% of all the dams, 90,000 dams in this country, will be more than 50 years old. And that means they were built back when we didn't know as much about engineering stress and those issues. Oroville, which had the near disaster in the early winter of 2017, was 48 years old at that time. So it wasn't even technically considered, you know, over the 50-year limit. So we have a serious problem, and I would suggest that, and I'd also add that fixing the damage to Oroville is probably going to cost about $500 million. So I would think if we're going to borrow money from Wall Street, we should be fixing existing dams rather than building new ones, primarily because not only a finance and environmental review, but the best sites with stable geology in unpopulated areas are already taken. So it just seems like we should be putting money into repairing existing dams, or even taking some dams where they're either hazardous or environmentally inappropriate, or taking some dams down.
Which has happened, as you point out in the book, and you mentioned Bruce Babbitt when he was Secretary of Interior swinging that sledgehammer, including at the old Bear Creek Dam right in downtown Medford. Have the dam removals produced the results they were hoped to produce?
Absolutely. The removal of the Elwha and Glynis Dam up in Puget Sound near Port Angeles, took probably, 15 years to negotiate because of, getting the parties to agree, and then Congress has to approve the dam removal process. And it's a complicated procedure, or I should say political process, perhaps, or negotiation. Removing the dams is not that hard. They removed both of those dams. One was, 100 feet high, and the other one was 210 feet high. They managed to manage the sediment flow out in a way that did not cause major damage to the downstream area. They, in the end, resulted in producing, nearly 20 acres of new beaches, which are, and that sediment is going to re-nourish the beaches, which is going to be very important protection for sea level rise. And within 2 years, they saw salmon migrating up the river.
All right, so the salmon do come back, which is good to know. Now, the San Joaquin River, I didn't realize, was such a great source of salmon. And what had happened to that salmon run over the years of controlling that river?
There's a dam down there near Fresno called the Fryant Dam that went in sort of in the World War II era, and it effectively dewatered a 60-mile stretch of the water below the dam, which has ended the salmon run on the San Joaquin River. because not only did they have a physical barrier with the Friant Dam, but the, you know, even to get as close as they could to their former spawning area, there's no water there. So there was an incredible agreement negotiated, led by my former employer, the NRDC, and a number of parties to produce a restoration project for that San Joaquin River that did not actually take the dam down. It would ensure that the farmers didn't take as much money, that there was a lot of restoration, habitat restoration, that some of the smaller barriers of, in the way of irrigation canals or diversion structures were removed, and there was great hope about it. There's federal money appropriated for it, but the problem has been that it, like the other parts of California, has suffered a nasty drought, which has meant that there was far less water available than they anticipated.
All right, much more to talk about Lori Mott. She has written a postscript to her husband Mark Reisner's book, Cadillac Desert, The American West and Its Disappearing Water. Back on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about water and dams and more with Lori Mott and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about water in the West. Generally, people live where the water isn't. Look at Los Angeles, 14 inches of rain a year. Las Vegas, four inches of rain a year, yet it manages to thrive in the desert somehow. It's very efficient with its use of water, but this is a situation all across the American West, as portrayed by Mark Reisner in his book Cadillac Desert, The American West and Its Disappearing Water, first published in 1986 and updated a few years later. Mark Reisner died in 2000. His widow, Lori Mott, herself a scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council for many years, has put a postscript on the book and reissued it as of last year. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about water in the West and all that entails. 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Roger in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Lori, fascinating subject. Fascinating. I'm just fascinated by this whole conversation. Do you know what I'm not hearing, though? I'm hearing all about these dams that are out of date and all the money that's going into this. Why isn't there more conversation on desalinization? We have 71% of our earth is covered with water, most of which is seawater. Why isn't there more discussion? That is the answer to all of these problems, is the desalinization of our oceans.
All
Do
right.
you not agree?
Let us find out why we're not talking more about taking water from the ocean and getting the salt out of it. So what's the story there, Lori? It is addressed in your postscript.
Right. There are actually some places looking at desal, as a short term for it. Particularly down in Southern California, Carlsbad, which is south of L.A., has built a huge desalinization plant. It's a huge financial investment. It is very energy intensive. It has marine environmental impacts in terms of it produces a huge amount of salt, you know, salt waste, if you will, and where to put that. And it's incredibly costly. That plant, it costs about $2,000 per acre to produce an acre foot of water, which is the amount of water to cover 1 acre a foot deep. When you compare that to the cost of, say, conservation, stormwater recycling, which are mostly in the $100 to $400 per acre foot. And so you not only have a huge cost, and you also, it's very energy intensive. So that's why, and needless to say, you need to be near the coast. And then there's the question of how do you get the water to the areas beyond the coast? It's something that works in oil-rich Middle East. I don't think it's the way we want to go. I think there are more economically and environmentally efficient ways of getting water. We've wasted a lot of water when we let stormwater run out to the ocean uncaptured. It causes a lot of pollution too. Look at what Las Vegas did with recycling all that water. I think it's obscene that we use potable water to flush our toilets. So I don't think desal is the answer. Interestingly, as kind of a side, there are areas where their groundwater has become too salty, inland areas. So they are considering doing some, what would you call it, desal light as a way to make that water usable for irrigation. So there are different options than just ocean desal, and some of these smaller options inland with sort of, if you will call it, brackish groundwater might be a more viable option. But in general, I think that, you know, desal is something that is expensive, energy intensive, and probably and not appropriate for the U.S.
Well, $2,000 an acre foot, that is, that's a lot for water. So I want to move on and talk a little more about groundwater here, because it's still kind of weird to me that California did not regulate groundwater until recently. And you include the information here about J. Family Yeti at NASA. What did he figure out about groundwater use in the last drought?
Well, what has happened is, as the states and federal government have restricted the amount of water that farmers can take from surface sources, what's happened when groundwater wasn't regulated in California until 2014, a law passed, was people just built wells and started sucking the groundwater up. As a result, the groundwater levels fell. Land subsided, you know, in some areas a foot a year, which is huge, because if you also think about that means roads buckling, that means bridges, you know, losing their structural integrity. And ironically, to me, it means that some of the canals that carried the surface water lost capacity, because suddenly most these canals are all gravity-fed, but if you suddenly have a part of the canal that drops a foot lower, or in some cases 2 or 3 feet lower, either not as much water, you lose a large part of the capacity of that, the carrying capacity of that canal. So California finally passed a law in 2014. I think it was the last state in the West to approve groundwater management. And even though the law has, it was legendary, landmark, all of those words that are applied to those kinds of pieces of legislation that were long overdue, it doesn't require sustainable ground management until 2024 at the earliest. So that's a long time for farmers to continue to use the groundwater as basically a, I don't know, unrestricted bank account. And what's also happened because of that is that some of the smaller communities and poorer communities in the Central Valley that had relied on well water because they did not live in an area where there was a water utility that piped water to them, they relied on shallow wells, and their wells have been failing. So this is not just something of, you know, the farmers are hurting all of us, and particularly those who depended on shallow wells for domestic water use.
So beyond the water sources, there is the water use as well, which you cover in your portion of Cadillac Desert. And so, for example, I mean, how common is flood irrigation still?
It's very common. I would say it's very common, but there's another fundamental problem, and this is mostly about California water use, which is that there's not good data on California water use. Even though we have two different agencies who are tasked with regulating and measuring and water use in California, there are not online accessible data about what percentage is in flood. It's probably about 50% now, and that just means they open the gate and it covers the entire field. It could be more, it could be less. As I said, the data is self-reported. The data is probably 4 or 5 years old at this point. You know, how can you manage what you can't measure? That's kind of like trying to go on a diet without the honesty of a bathroom scale.
So at some point, though, Lori, does it become economical to begin drip irrigating, which apparently is a lot of the resistance here?
It does become economical. If not economical, it becomes essential, because I think that the state and federal water agencies have got to stop acting as if there is an unlimited flow of water. I think they have to stop bending to the pressure of the agricultural interests who are living in the last century. And I think they have to say it's time that you have to reduce your water use by 20%, and here's some financial incentives for switching to drip irrigation. That's the part of the water situation that we're in that worries me the most is agriculture. And particularly it's some of the largest players. It's the Westlands Water District, which is about the size of Rhode Island.
Which we've talked to a few times, yeah.
And it is, you know, they're a huge political player.
They are.
You know, they have congressional ties. And interestingly, they decided not to support the big tunnels project, the twin tunnels project that Governor Brown is pushing because they decided it was even too expensive for them. But they are, you know, they're big farmers that are big political interests, and they've pushed back on the powers that be that regulate water in California, and I've been pretty disappointed in some cases about it.
How resistant is the ag industry to changing crops? I know with tree crops it's not easy, obviously, but for the rest of it?
Well, I guess I would say they haven't been, they've been very eager to plant almond orchards. They certainly can change crops to almonds. Because they, you know, I think they are resistant to change where it hurts their bottom line is basically what it is. I mean, they ripped up a bunch of row crops that are, you know, annual crops of melons and tomatoes and planted almonds. And you drive around, you know, parts of the Central Valley that either were previously planted in row crops or heretofore were never planted, and suddenly you see young almond trees everywhere. And I don't know where they think they're going to get the water. Maybe they're hoping to put them in before, you know, the full effect of the groundwater regulations go take place. And I suspect that once they have those trees established, they'll be able to claim, you know, we put this money in, we put these trees here, now we need water every year for trees, because obviously you can't stop watering a tree. You can stop watering an alfalfa crop, or you can skip a year of tomatoes. But trees, grapes, nuts, you know, that's the shift that I'm concerned about with agriculture.
I want to come back and talk about one of the streams that you mentioned in your postscript to Cadillac Desert, because it's right smack in the middle of our listening area, and that's the Klamath River, which you describe as the center of a notorious saga. You'll find a lot of people agreeing with that. But the Klamath Dam removal that appears to be moving ahead now, there's a corporation set up to take ownership of the dams, et cetera. I get a sense there's still some lingering doubt that this is going to happen.
Well, this would be the largest dam removal in the U.S. It's very exciting. These are dams that no longer, you know, generate power at a cost-effective rate. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission said that in order to relicense the dams, they would have to build fish ladders, and that would cost $100 million more than taking the dams out. So the dam owner, Pacific Corp, went ahead, as you said. Four of the six dams are slated for removal. It was a very tricky political process, and right now it's up to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to approve the removal process. Everything is political right now with the federal government. Is you never know. You could wake up tomorrow morning and Twitter could, who knows what Trump could be tweeting about. I hope it's not the Klamath. Let's just put it that way. I think this is a project that's been long in the making. I'm confident that the dam removal will occur in a way that there will be the sediment flow will be managed, the river will be restored, the ranchers and farmers in the upper reaches of the Klamath will still get enough water to survive and continue their way of life, and the indigenous people will hopefully get increased numbers of salmon returning to their, you know, their original hunting grounds.
So I do want to ask about something that Stan in Ashland wants to know about. He says, shouldn't we be talking about population, too?
I'd love to talk about population, but that's kind of, you know, that's the third rail. You know, no.
Is it still in environmental circles to talk about population?
Well, no. I mean, I agree that I think population growth is a huge issue. I'm talking about from a political perspective.
Sure.
That cities, you know, their cities could limit the amount. They could say we're not going to have any more than this number of water meters. I know of one small town in California on the California coast that has said basically we've capped out at the number of water meters we are going to have. If you cannot. You know, you can't build a new house here unless you can convince somebody else to let you tie into their water meter or that kind of thing. But this is Bolinas, California, which is pretty exceptional if anybody knows that area. But you know, that's to me where water is concerned. The one thing to do would be to limit the number of water connections. I don't think you can prevent people from moving to certain places if they want to. I personally believe in zero population growth, and you know, wish that were, I guess. We only have two children.
You kept it at ZPG in your own family.
Yeah.
I noticed you mentioned, I just want to get this in before we go, that the California Water Plan update for the next 5 years is due out next month. Is this the kind of thing that you attend? Are you interested at that
level? Oh, yeah, I'll be following it. And there will be some, you know, it'll be interesting to see what has, it's every 5 years. I mean, now that's another thing that I think is in an area, in a state where water is so contested, precious, fought over. Why would you have only updated every 5 years?
Well, that is a question we'll leave on the table there. There's a lot of questions and a lot of information in both Cadillac Desert and Lori Mott's new postscript, Cadillac Desert, the American West and its Disappearing Water, first published by Mark Reisner in 1986. Lori Mott was married to him, was herself a scientist at the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council. Lori, thanks so much for writing the postscript and for joining us today on The Exchange.
My pleasure to be with you.
Good to have you.